What is the biggest difference, both sort of institutionally, but maybe also culturally, between banking in the US and banking in China?
I don't think we can understand China by being judgmental about China. In other words, applying American standards to China won't enable us to recognize some of the inherent advantages in the Chinese approach.
China 21 is produced by the 21st Century China Program at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. We are a university-based think tank that produces original research to anchor major policy discussions on China and its relationship to the United States. Learn more at china.ucsd.edu. Welcome to China 21, the official podcast for the 21st Century China Program. I'm Samuel Choi, Assistant Director. This podcast features expert voices, insights, and stories about China's economy, politics, society, and the implications for international affairs. In global finance today, the question that is on the minds of many is this: what are the implications of China's economic slowdown, especially if growth continues to decelerate? To get an inside look at how banking practices have evolved to respond to recent financial crises in China, we have Professor Victor Shi, Associate Professor of Political Science here at GPS, and Mr. Ken Wilcox, Emeritus Chairman of Silicon Valley Bank, here to shed some light on this timely topic. Professor Shi is a leading expert in examining the intersection of China's elite politics and the People's Republic's financial policies. He has written widely on the topic and teaches a course at UC San Diego on financing the Chinese economic miracle. Not only does Professor Shi have an authoritative voice on the subject, he has gained a following on Twitter for his interesting takes on China's politics and economy. You can join over 12,000 others on Twitter by following him at VSHIH2. Ken Wilcox is the Emeritus Chairman at Silicon Valley Bank. He previously served as CEO of SVB Financial Group. In that role, he successfully pursued a strategy of expansion into China. In 2011, he made the key decision to relocate to Shanghai to lead a joint venture with a state-owned Shanghai Pudong Development Bank that proved to be a critical factor in SVB's pioneering role in expanding financial services in the innovation sector and SVB's overall success in China. Mr. Wilcox was on the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, and he still serves on several corporate and nonprofit boards, including the Asia Society of Northern California. He is also an adjunct professor at Fudan University in Shanghai. Among many other accolades, Mr. Wilcox was honored by the Shanghai Municipal Government with the Magnolia Silver Award, a municipal honor given to expatriates for their outstanding contribution to the city's economic, social, or cultural development.
Ken, it's a great honor and privilege to have you here with us at UCSD. And, you know, given your very rich experience in banking, both in the U.S. and in China, I thought we would, you know, cover a few, you know, broad questions and then maybe narrow down into some specific questions. So the first question I do want to ask you is that because you have served as senior level banker both in the U.S. and in China, in your opinion, what is the biggest difference, both sort of institutionally, but maybe also culturally, between banking in the U.S. and banking in China?
Two big differences that result in a lot of smaller differences. The first big difference would be that all the banks in China are owned by the government. And I think that's hard to appreciate until you've lived with it, because you can intellectually recognize the fact that the banks are owned by the government. But until you actually live in that situation, it's hard to see what that really means. There is no distinction between the government and the banks. They're one and the same thing. The result is, in the same way that the government never fails or goes bankrupt, the banks don't either. There's never been a bank in China that's gone bankrupt, that's gone out of business. Whereas here in the U.S., we have built banks that go out of business every single year. I don't think there's ever been a year that we haven't had some bank failures, sometimes lots and lots of bank failures. Of course, if you're never going to go out of business, you can grow as fast as you want. It doesn't make any difference. So banks in China will grow much, much faster than they do here, and the bankers are incented to grow fast. Here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve is pretty determined that bankers will be compensated in a way that will discourage too much risk-taking and therefore growth that's too rapid. But in China, it's quite a bit different. Base salary might comprise for the average banker only about 30% of their total take. And the other 70% would be volume-based incentive. So they grow really, really fast. And of course, one thing that I didn't even realize till I spent time there, pay packages for bankers are state secrets. Nobody knows what they are, and I think that's largely because the populace might be really upset if they knew how much bankers were being paid, which is quite a bit more.
But I thought the salaries are published in the annual reports, right, for the listed banks. But you're saying besides the salary, there's actually quite extensive bonus packages that are not disclosed.
That's totally correct. Yeah, so, you know, in the same way that you can hire one of the consulting firms here in the U.S. to tell you how much a vice president will get paid at a mid-sized bank and how much a senior vice president will get paid and so on and so forth, those statistics, to the extent that you hire a consultant in China, those statistics only include foreign banks. They don't include Chinese banks. And when we ask our joint venture partner how much we should pay some of the people from their bank who were seconded to our bank, they said, we can't tell you. That is a state secret. And you just pay them whatever you think is appropriate. If you pay them too much, we'll keep the extra. And if you don't pay them enough, we'll pay them extra. These are employees seconded to us from the joint venture partner.
So then what did you do in response to that guidance, I guess, from SPDB? Well, because you can look at SPDB annual report and say, did you say that, well, I see in the annual report that your CEO and, you know, the chief officers were paid this amount. We'll take 70% of that, and that's how much we're going to pay your people.
Well, of course, in the annual report you're referring to, it refers only to the top, and I'm talking now about the middle.
Sure.
And it doesn't say anything in the middle about the middle in the annual report.
Right.
So
right.
We just guessed and and let it go at that. The other big difference, in my opinion, is that the regulators in China, although on the surface they look very much like the Federal Reserve, they in many regards they operate differently. China has a huge number of regulations. I think it's amazing that our Federal Reserve has been in existence now for, over 100 years, and that the counterpart to our Federal Reserve in China, the CBRC, has only been in existence now since, I think, 2002, which would be 14 years. And I'm absolutely positive they have more regulations than we do. And when you've got that many regulations, you have no choice. You have to enforce them selectively. And regulations are enforced selectively, which means there's a lot of discretion. And that discretion, at least in my perception, is often used in a way that discriminates against certain banks, specifically foreign banks, and in a way that ultimately protects domestic banks from competition. But the other interesting thing is if you get a banking license in China, it's only a starting point. It doesn't mean you can actually operate as a bank might. Whereas in the U.S., you get a banking license. Even a Chinese bank gets a banking license in the U.S. It can do anything that any other bank can do. Not in China. You get a banking license, and then after that, you have to secure a license to take deposits, which is distinct from the banking license. And then you have to secure a license to engage in foreign exchange. You even have to have a separate license to offer your clients online banking. And of course, nobody's going to bank with a bank if the bank doesn't have online banking in today's world. But in China, there's actually a one-year waiting period after you open your bank before you can apply for and be granted a license to offer online banking.
That's right. And these licenses are issued by different agencies, right? It's not necessarily the CBRC. Online banking might be issued by like some association, right? Like the Payment Association or the PBOC or something, right?
Now that part I'm not entirely sure about myself. I just know that we
right,
we had to go to various
people, right?
Yeah, a lot of different
Yeah. So to get back on your first point, you mentioned that, you know, because the banks mostly are state-owned, you know, there are one or two exceptions like Minsheng Bank or Zheshang Bank. They basically, there's this classic problem of moral hazard, you know, where their incentive is to say, well, you know, if the government's going to bail me out at the end of the day, perhaps I can just race ahead and expand the balance sheet as quickly as possible. In what other way is the moral hazard affecting bankers' behavior in China? Like, are they lending to a certain kind of firms because of this moral hazard, or you know, what other kinds of behavior would they engage in?
Interestingly enough, the range of companies that a bank in China might lend to is, in my perception, somewhat narrower than would be true in the U.S. The Chinese banks lend almost exclusively to state-owned enterprises and to real estate undertakings that ultimately almost always have a fairly strong element of government support. So, again, lending to the government. In effect, the Chinese banks are the government lending to itself. And they also, the third category is they lend often to municipalities and are owned by the same municipalities. So they're, in some respects, piggy banks for the municipalities. So the mayor or the mayors of a town or a city may well just turn to the bank whenever they need money for any project, which has resulted, of course, in a huge level of municipal debt in China that in some cases may never really get repaid.
And so this kind of behavior, well, it's something that I've done some research on, local debt. But it is surprising that this kind of behavior would, are you saying this kind of behavior even would be pervasive in a city like Shanghai, you know, where you were living and working? Because, you know, Shanghai is known to be this very dynamic city with a lot of private sector activities and a lot of banks competing for businesses of, you know, foreign borrowers, JV borrowers, and also domestic investors. Why do you think, you know, even in a place like Shanghai or in eastern China, Jiangsu, Zhejiang province, like this kind of phenomenon is still, you know, from what you're saying, is still somewhat pervasive in such a dynamic place?
I would say it is somewhat pervasive, but I would also say that it's very difficult to prove the point no matter which side you're on, because information is not readily available. And a lot of things from at least a Western point of view, and I believe also from a Chinese point of view, having discussed this at length with many of my friends and colleagues who are Chinese living in China, they too have difficulty discerning. I think information is it's hard to get a hold of. Situations are not transparent.
So when I was doing my dissertation back in the early 2000s, that was when Zhurongji rolled out a lot of new banking regulations, but also internal procedures in the banks. You know, the banks, Chinese banks for the first time, you know, had credit committees, had all these standardized procedures that supposedly adhered to best international practices in terms of approving loans. Are those procedures still largely in place, but and also are they meaningful procedures in terms of approving loans? Because from what you're saying, it seems like there is a formal procedure and then there is an informal procedure whereby the vice mayor would just make a telephone call to the bank and then something gets approved. What procedure would you say is more important these days?
Well, I think just like almost everything else in China, there are layers of truth, and it's difficult to discern. So the procedures are there. There's no question about that. Although I will say, as you said yourself a second ago, they were introduced relatively recently, prior to the establishment of the CBRC as a separate and distinct entity. In, I believe, 2002. In 2002, I believe it was split out and separated and became a genuine regulator, at least in terms of its image and people's perception. Liu Mengkang, very famous man, was the first head of the CBRC in China, and he introduced the concept of underwriting, largely in response to a couple of different things: China's entry into the WTO, as well as China's desire to have access to foreign capital markets to support their banks, to provide additional capital for their banks. So they proceeded to introduce underwriting. Prior to that, underwriting in China, as I understand it from people in China, consisted basically of people making telephone calls and saying to the banks, somebody in government calling somebody in a bank and saying, provide so much money, not debt, not equity, just money, to this SOE or this municipality or this real estate project. And that's what happened. Underwriting was then introduced. I would say that it's only been around now for 14 years, and that's an art that takes a while to develop. So I don't think the underwriting standards are quite as widely recognized or quite as firmly in place as you would say they are in some of the Western countries.
Well, recently I've even heard even more draconian procedures, like tying individual loans to the responsibility of individual credit officers. And if that loan were to go bad, then this person would have to like find a way to get the loan repaid and get their pay docked and so on and so forth. Mm. But it seems like that even that rule was probably applied selectively, and it doesn't really apply to certain projects. You know, if it's government-backed project, then it may not apply.
I think that's right. You know. And I think that from a big picture point of view, the way to think about this is as follows, that in any system, you're going to have two potential sources of motivation. One of them will be rules and procedures and laws, and the other one will be things that people want to accomplish based on their values and, in some cases, their personal interests. And there's a spectrum then. Let's say rules and laws at one end and personal interests and values at the other end. I would say in the Western countries, particularly the U.S., we lean toward the rule end, governance by rule. And in China, we lean more toward the judgment end. What will fit my purpose at this point in time? So it's not always a rule. It's not always ROE.
Right. So So in that sense, there could be some similarities. So shifting gears a little bit, I do want to talk about the entrepreneurial and venture capital scene in both the U.S. and in China. Again, you know, as someone who was president of Silicon Valley Bank, dealing with a lot of startups, including my sister's company, what do you find any big differences between startups and venture capital in California versus in Shanghai or in China in general?
Sure, of course. But before I get started, I just want to say I was not aware that your sister's company was a client. Now that you say that, I just hope that we're taking good care of her.
She's happy.
Good. That's good to hear. Hey, let me start with the question. Entrepreneurs, are Chinese entrepreneurs different from American entrepreneurs or U.S. entrepreneurs? And on the surface, I would say absolutely not. What makes an entrepreneur is almost universal. It's a personality structure. It's a way of thinking about life. And it's a desire to accomplish something great. And in that sense, Chinese entrepreneurs and American entrepreneurs are identical. You can just pull them out of one environment, stick them into the other, and they'll behave in exactly the same way. That said, of course, the environment in which they're operating in China is totally different in so many regards. And the result is, in terms of behaviors, you will see differences. And I'll just list a few here. First of all, in the U.S., I've never met an entrepreneur, very few, I should say, entrepreneurs that were in any way dependent on the government or any recognizable way dependent on the government. And American entrepreneurs either don't think about the government, or to the extent that they do, they try to avoid it, probably. Whereas Chinese entrepreneurs often see the government as somebody they have to deal with, maybe even a friendly force, and will go out of their way to curry favor with government officials to make sure that they're getting the maximum level of support, because the government is involved in all aspects of business in China, which is, again, I don't think that's easy to appreciate until you're actually in it, in the mix. Secondly, the Chinese ecosystem for the entrepreneurial ecosystem is quite a bit different than the U.S. In a number of different ways. First of all, because there is very little in the way of intellectual property protection, at least that's one reason. There may be others. I think Chinese entrepreneurs, in a sense, take less risk because they want to get to market faster, because they're less dependent on legal protection of their IP than they would be in a Western country, and more dependent on speed to market. That's the competitive advantage, speed to market. The result is that they often move in the direction of copying in a way. And I think we Americans misunderstand the copying in China. We think that, I mean, Americans sometimes will say things like, you know, Chinese really aren't good at innovating, they're only good at copying. Well, I don't agree with that at all. And I think that the motivation for copying has nothing to do with a lack of capacity for innovation. It has to do with the fact that they need to be they emphasize speed to market. So take Xiaomi, for example, introducing a product like GoPro. They waited until GoPro had built the market and there was product acceptance, and then they entered with their own product in order to take some of the risk out of the equation and in order to bring it to a level of profitability much, much faster. So they're not doing the missionary work, so to speak. They rely on others to do that, often American companies. Alibaba with Taobao, and waiting until eBay has built the market acceptance for the concept, then they spring into action with less risk on their hands because they're not training the market to buy in a certain way. So that's another difference. Of course, I think lack of intellectual property protection also plays a role in that equation somewhat. I think also Chinese entrepreneurs, in addition to putting the emphasis on speed to market because there is little intellectual property protection, also are correspondingly less interested in quality. It's not the quality of the product. It's not, you know, making the best iPhone in the universe. It's getting it to market quick. So Xiaomi it would take that approach. Their product is fine. Its quality is perhaps not as high as a Samsung or an iPhone. But at the same time, they're moving very, very fast. And I also think one other point that Chinese entrepreneurs have not taken too many courses on averaging corporate finance. So whereas Western entrepreneurs will often follow a very set procedure, which is I get seed money from an angel, later I move to a venture capitalist, and perhaps later I move to a bank. Chinese entrepreneurs look for money anywhere, and they don't care whether it's debt or equity. They just want a deal.
They just want cash. Yeah, I mean, that seems to be a common theme in China. But so from a banker's perspective, is it better to bank, to do business, I guess, lend money to or take deposits from entrepreneurs who are very concerned with speed to market and generating revenue? It seems like that's a good thing from the perspective of a banker. What would you say?
I would say there's no a black or white answer to that question. In some regards, American entrepreneurs are more comforting to a bank like ours, and in some regards, Chinese entrepreneurs are more comforting to a bank like ours. I think in trying to understand China, it's good to avoid being judgmental and to look for not just disadvantages but advantages on either side of the equation. One thing that you haven't mentioned yet, though, that I think you'll want to, and let me jump right into it, is Chinese venture capitalists.
Yep.
Because that's the venture capitalists, in our estimation, are a very important element in the entrepreneurial ecosystem. And Chinese venture capitalists are in some ways similar to their U.S. counterparts, but in some ways quite a bit different. First of all, largely because the venture capital industry in China is only about 15 years old, and in the U.S. now we're in our, I don't know what, sixth decade, seventh decade, something like that. They tend to be much, much younger and correspondingly less experienced, and also much more interested in products and services that, for which there is an established market already. So often the Chinese venture capitalists don't start funding companies until they're profitable, which is hardly the case in the U.S. Don't start funding companies until they're profitable and then expect an IPO within a couple of years or a liquidity event within a couple of years, as opposed to the historic, you know, 5, 7, maybe even 10 years. Their LPs often have some element of government aspect to them too. So in a way, you could perceive them as arms of the government. They're not technically arms of the government, but they're using often government money, which has another corollary side effect, and that is that it's not always ROE that counts. Sometimes there are other considerations. We've seen often, actually, situations in which we were astounded because the money wasn't being deployed with ROE first and foremost as the goal. It could have been some other goal, which is, again, it has advantages and disadvantages. I don't think we can understand China by being judgmental about China. In other words, applying American standards to China won't enable us to recognize some of the inherent advantages in the Chinese approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I've heard whether or not the government is behind the scene as an LP, that's one issue. But the other thing I've heard a lot is that VCs in China, a lot of times they will take shares, pre-IPO shares, and then somehow try to lever that up, by putting up shares as collateral, you know, whether listed or unlisted companies, and then getting money and then engaging in some other kind of speculation. Like, do you see a lot of this kind of situation, and is it a sort of a worry for a bank?
Well, first of all, we do see a lot. And secondly, it's sometimes hard to categorize because it comes in various forms and it's constantly reinventing itself. And anybody who says Chinese are not innovative just need to take a look at some of the things you're talking about, which is a form of innovation and pretty clever, I think, fast moving and insightful. And yeah, they worry us sometimes. Sometimes they worry us less because they're problematic and more because they're just things that we're not used to and that we feel uncomfortable with for that reason. Sometimes they worry us because they involve a phenomenon that is important to understand China, and that is conflict of interest, meaning what would be in an American's eyes a conflict of interest is often a source of comfort to a Chinese observer. So I've had more than one conversation with friends in business and in government in China in which they say that their whole view of life, that is that guanqi or relationships in the Chinese sense are important, that from their perspective, that's a source of huge comfort because they always know that they're dealing with people that they know well and that they trust, whereas a lot of what goes under the name of or the term guanqi in China, from an American perspective, it actually involves out-and-out conflict of interest. So that ends up being a big problem for Americans working in China.
No, so I think you've identified something that's very interesting, which is that for us, I guess in outside of China or in the West or whatever, conflict of interest is worrisome because borrowers who maybe should not get money maybe are getting financing because of their connections. But on the other hand, I think, you know, a Chinese entrepreneur or bankers may say that, well, but we have more information on these individuals because we know them. On balance,
exactly.
Who would you say is right?
There is no right here. It's a question of your own value system and your own belief. So having been schooled in the U.S. and being very sensitive to conflict of interest, of course it troubles me when I see things that look like conflict of interest. But if I had grown up in China, I would look at it totally differently. And I think that's one of the big lessons here. Spending time in China, you over time, if you got any sense at all, you come to the conclusion that sometimes people in other parts of the world view something, a phenomenon, radically differently from the way we do. And it doesn't make them wrong. It only makes them wrong within the context of the U.S. value system.
And finally, a lot of people, including myself, saying kind of bearish things about China because the debt level is very high. We know very likely that a lot of loans are just getting rolled over by the banks. Would you say that things are becoming worrisome in China? Or do you think that, this is just, as you just pointed out, just the way that China works, and probably somehow the government in combination with the state banks will get through this period of difficulty, and it's not going to manifest in any kind of sharp slowdown or crisis?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there is a slowdown. There's absolutely no doubt. I was just in China 2 weeks ago for 10 days, and everywhere I went, people told me that there was a slowdown. So there's no doubt in my mind there's a slowdown. That said, I am not one of those people who is forecasting a hard landing for China. I guess at one level, I feel like forecasting that because I'm imbued with American standards and economic principles. And if I apply American standards and economic principles to the Chinese economy, it sure looks like it's going to result in a hard landing. But I'm not sure they're applicable because the systems are so radically different. They're just not the same. I mean, consider this. Consider a sort of a closed system that's suddenly is wrong, but in the past couple of decades, accrued trillions of dollars in trade surplus, which ultimately finds its way to the government. It finds its way to the government because either the government owns the companies that are generating the trade surplus themselves, or if they don't, they're taxing the companies. And finally, all of the people that work in those companies are saving at the rate of 50% potentially of their income, so it all goes into banks that are owned by the government. So the government can use that money for lending purposes. Ultimately, the government has access to that, to those trillions of dollars in trade surplus. Whereas in the U.S., that trade surplus might be in private hands. It's ultimately, to one degree or another, in government hands. And that's a different system. That is a totally different system. And it's hard to say how that will work out because we're just not used to thinking about the world that way.
Of course, China did lose nearly $1 trillion from its foreign exchange reserve in the past 16 months or so. So the result, who knows, right? I agree with you. I mean, it's uncertain what the actual outcome will be. Anyway, thank you so much for doing the podcast with us. And I'm sure our listeners will benefit greatly from it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to China 21, the podcast of the 21st Century China Program at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. Visit china.ucsd.edu and connect with us on social media. 谢谢大家.